Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. The Olympic Games in Russia and the Yanukovych era in Ukraine appear to be over. So end Putin's Olympic dreams and perhaps his imperial dreams. We are lucky to have back with us this morning the New Yorker magazine editor-in-chief, David Remnick, Russia expert, among many other things, who was on with us. Who was on with us before the games and did opening ceremonies commentary for NBC. His article in The New Yorker out today is called Patriot Games. Vladimir Putin lives his Olympic dream. Hi, David. Thanks so much for doing this. Vladimir Putin lives his Olympic dream. Your subtitle, what was his Olympic dream and did it come true?
Hey, Brian. It's good to be back with you. And good to be back from Sochi. The dream was to reassert Russia, to put Russia in a pop culture sort of way on the world stage in a right front and center after a generation after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I think in some ways he succeeded. The games went off safely from opening to closing ceremonies. There were exciting moments athletically. I don't think anybody can deny that. And they even had a kind of ironic wink to their own screw-up with the fifth Olympic ring not opening in the opening ceremonies, and they kind of had an ironic, very Russian, funny moment in the closing ceremonies.
Making fun of themselves
themselves. I thought that was terrific. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, during this Olympics, we had the spectacle of Cossacks using horse whips to beat up Pussy Riot. We had, you know, a revolution going on in Ukraine, which has enormous impact for Russian statehood and Russian psychology, to say nothing of Ukraine itself. And all the issues of Russian authoritarianism persist. And I even think that after the Olympics, you could well see a kind of crackdown or a further crackdown in the country now that the eyes of the world turn away from Moscow.
I like the section of your article where you describe the opening ceremonies of the Sochi Olympics in terms of what Russia was trying to say about itself to the rest of the world watching on television. And you compare that to the Beijing Olympics opening ceremonies, which were similarly self-conscious in a geopolitical way. You called the ceremony the perfect theatrical embodiment of Putinism. How so?
Well, it was surprisingly open in a certain cultural way. Well, let's just start by saying, you know, there's a kitschy aspect to this whole thing. There's a kind of Cirque du Soleil aspect, and we shouldn't, you know, have opening ceremonies be taken too seriously. But on the other hand, they showed a certain cultural openness. You had a lot of artists who would never have been spoken of in the Soviet period being celebrated in these opening ceremonies and in the closing ceremonies. Last night I was, I have to say, even astonished to see a gigantic portrait of none other than Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I mean, that's
incredible.
Amazing thing. And credit where credit is due. But the fact is that Putin doesn't give a damn if you're reading Solzhenitsyn or Brodsky or Zinoviev or whatever. That's fine. He knows the audience for that is small and limited. What was interesting in the opening ceremonies was the incredibly pasteurized, highly selective vision of what Russian and Soviet history has been. Again, realizing totally that an opening ceremony is never going to be awash in gloom and blood and all the rest, but it was very, very interesting the way they did it.
Right. But you refer, for example, to a springtime for Stalin moment. People who know the producer, springtime for Hitler, ha, ha, ha. So you say springtime for Stalin moment in the opening ceremonies, giddy tenors and uniforms of notorious enforcers singing Get Lucky by Daft Punk. What was that exactly?
It was unbelievable. That was the viral video that came out of the first days of the Olympics, is the Interior Ministry police in their uniforms singing Daft Punk. It was bizarro land, really bizarre. Because the Interior Ministry police, Brian, that's who's on the case at Moscow demonstrations. They're their headquarters on Petrovka Street are, you know, one cut below Lubyanka, in the kind of resonant, horrifying litany of addresses in old Moscow.
The picture you paint.
To hear them singing a pop song like that was just, you know, something from the other side of the moon.
So, absolutely, other side of the moon, surreal, offensive, totalitarian. And the picture you paint of Putin then is of a cartoon macho man. He really doesn't care if his country is actually successful in terms of a prosperous, happy people. He cares if Russia is seen as powerful in the basis.
No, I disagree. I do think, Brian, that he cares that it's prosperous. I think that's part of the picture. You could argue that the prosperity all floats to the top.
Yes.
I think that's very much the case.
But he cares mostly, correct me if I'm wrong, according to you, if Russia is seen as powerful in the basest, most mine is bigger than yours kind of way. Is that the impression you're trying to leave us with?
Your words, not mine. But yes, I think that's
I couldn't
that's
get true. That. I couldn't get that phrase into the New Yorker.
You can, but maybe not in this piece. You know, the Soviet Union absolutely stunningly collapsed in 1991. Just collapsed, and its 15 republics went their separate ways. The economy collapsed, and there were signs of democratic change, but that didn't go the way anyone had hoped. And Putin is all about the reassertion. He's what's called in Russian a государственник, a state maker. He wants to reassert the psychology of greatness rather than a down in the mouth position that he feels Russia has been in now for a generation. And that accounts for his swagger. It accounts for his self-created cartoon as a kind of vital macho man. Remember, this is a country where the last three leaders of the Soviet Union could barely speak. They were so old and decrepit. Yeltsin was seen, the cartoon of him was as a kind of stumbling drunk. So here's this guy who's, you know, bare-chested on a horse and tranquilizing a tiger and flying with cranes and all this stuff that reads hilarious in on the Daily Show and Colbert and mm-hmm. in the New Yorker and everywhere else. But at home, for the conservative, what Nixon used to call silent majority, it reads vital. It reads assertive in a way that Russians haven't experienced in a long time.
David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, with us on WNYC, back from Sochi. The terrorism threat from the Caucasus that everybody talked about before the games did not materialize. Athlete revolt over Putin's anti-gay laws did not materialize. But there was the ugly spectacle that you've already referred to last week of members from the protest band Pussy Riot showing up about 20 miles from Sochi and trying to sing a satirical song called Putin Will Teach You to Love the Motherland. And to describe what happened next, you used the word Cossacks. Want to take it from there?
Well, I don't know about you, Brian, but I probably live in this country as opposed to somewhere in the Russian Empire because of Cossacks chasing grandparents and great-grandparents out of places like what we're describing.
I'll subscribe to that.
And so right now, Cossacks in the southern part of Russia are empowered as law enforcement, and which is a bizarre thing to in the Western imagination. But in the local imagination, it's the most natural thing in the world. And by the way, you hear some of this on the far right in far-right nationalists in Ukraine. I don't want to suggest for one second that that's the dominant strain on the streets of Kiev. By no means is that the case, but mm-hmm. there unfortunately is that kind of that strain there too.
How are they, by the way, the band members? And do Putin's Cossacks have no sense of shame or no sense of irony or potential New York Post headlines that they
Or no sense of public relations.
I mean,
it just couldn't be stupider. And by the way, I should say today in Moscow, those members of Pussy Riot were back on the streets outside of a courtroom in Moscow. And guess what? They were arrested again. And
they were
handled, you know, in the same subtle way as they were in outside Sochi.
We have been witnessing the surreal contrast of the triumphalist Olympics taking place in Russia as Putin's ally is run out of power in Ukraine. In fact, you tied the two together in one line in your article, before he was run out of power. So the Olympics, some bobsledding, lugeing, and curling. How does Putin's image come out at the end of these 2 weeks?
Well, Ukraine is really complicated for Russia. Let's just put that to – we can get to that in a second. But I think his image for the people he cares about most, which is his majority support in Russia still to this day, and the way it's broadcast on highly controlled state television, does pretty well. Again, there was no terrorism. There was nothing terribly embarrassing to him that state television would have bothered to broadcast. That's an important thing to add. Ukraine for Russia is a very complicated and painful situation. Ukraine and Russia are tied together by history, by language, like no other two former republics of the Soviet Union. It's maybe Belarus as well. And for Putin to see Ukraine drift further and further out of his orbit at a time when he wants to establish something called a Eurasian Union, with Ukraine potentially as a cornerstone of that, is geopolitically rough on him, to say the least. He can, with reason, although Yanukovych, you know, proved himself an incredibly brutal and corrupt figure, he can always point to the fact that Yanukovych was a democratically elected leader, no matter how corrupt, no matter how awful. So you were about to enter a stage of really complicated struggle, diplomacy, conflict, both inside Ukraine and then between and among the countries involved in this, including the United States.
And what you write in the article is, in Putin's eyes, Russia had allowed the West to humiliate it by expanding NATO to its frontiers, by luring former Soviet republics, especially Ukraine, westward, by bombing Serbia and Kosovo, and as the self-proclaimed power in a unipolar world, by dancing in the end zone at every opportunity, referring to the United States. Sochi was meant to put a stop to all that. So the conflict in Ukraine is very much about whether that country will tilt toward Russia or will tilt toward the rest, the West. Do you see what's happening on the streets of Kiev as even a personal repudiation of Putin?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In many of the signs and slogans, they are very anti-Putin. But remember the division in Ukraine. Ukraine has been an independent nation now for a generation. We're not in 1992 now. This is not just 2 seconds after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But nevertheless, you have, in rough terms, you have the east part of the country is highly industrialized, speaks mainly Russian, and cleaves toward Russia in politically and emotionally. The western part of the country, with Lvov, or Lviv as it's now again called, as a typical city in this, cleaves toward the west, toward Europe. Remember, parts of Ukraine used to be parts of Poland and parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's a highly complex history and geography. And the Crimean Peninsula also has major pro-Russian elements to it. And it's a potentially rich country that's three-quarters broke, and broke economically and broke in every way. Despite the Orange Revolution a decade ago, the country never managed to establish stable democratic institutions. And it wasn't just Yanukovych who turned out to be a failure. Even Yushchenko, who was the product of the Orange Revolution, was nobody's answer to the future of Ukraine.
So the news this morning, and we're going to run out of time soon, is that Putin has recalled the Russian ambassador to Ukraine. What do you think that move signifies in and of itself? And are you in the camp that thinks Putin might intervene militarily in Ukraine because Russian prestige and regional power and legitimacy are seen to be at stake?
I would be shocked in every way, emotionally, morally, and intellectually, to see Russia intervene militarily. Toward what end and how? I just can't see the logic in it, much less leave aside the humanity of it. So I would be very surprised. But that he's in a very, at best, confused state about what to do in Ukraine goes without saying. Yanukovych was his ally and to some extent his tool. And the rhetoric coming out of the new leadership of Ukraine, however temporary it may be, is much more leaning toward the European Union. And that makes him very, very nervous.
I heard someone suggest on one of the Sunday shows yesterday that Putin was the architect of the violent crackdown against the protesters in Ukraine. Do you think that's possible? Does he have that much control?
I don't have the evidence for that. And I think the notion that somehow he ordered it or encouraged it directly, I think the journalism on that and the history on that remains to be seen. We don't have those transcripts. I think to just suppose that it's true just because Putin is extremely powerful and maybe even inclined toward that direction is premature. But what I will say is that this is Putin's nightmare. The reason he is so at best ambivalent about the West and even aggressive toward it at times is that he thinks the United States in the main, but also the West in general, foments revolutions like that in Ukraine and are actively doing so on the streets, even in Moscow. And when Putin returned to office 2 years ago, remember what was happening. There were huge demonstrations in Moscow. He came back into office, and he very methodically went about crushing or suppressing those leaders and elements that were pressing up against the walls of the Kremlin. He will have none of that.
David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker. His article in the new edition out today is Patriot Games: Vladimir Putin Lives His Olympic Dream. David, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.